Hello, good evening, and welcome to Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. I am Dr. Randall Brewer, and I will be your host again this evening as we continue to cover the COVID-19 pandemic as information changes nearly daily. We remain dedicated to bringing to you experts in the field of infectious disease and epidemiology, as well as virology, to deliver to you the best information possible about this virus, its prevention, as well as treatments. This evening, we will talk more about the virus, the symptoms caused by the disease caused by this new coronavirus called COVID-19, as well as talk about what's pertinent to the current conversation about the effects of this virus on children. I'm joined tonight by Dr. Joseph Bocchini. He is a pediatric infectious disease expert currently with the Willis-Knighton Health System and chief of pediatrics in the Willis-Knighton Health System. Dr. Bocchini, it's always a pleasure to have you with us here on Health Matters tonight. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
I'm happy to be involved. Thank you.
You know, Dr. Bocchini, we're looking at 6 months. You know, this it's called COVID-19. Some people don't understand that the 19's not a random number. It's because we found out about this virus in 2019, right?
Correct.
And so we're coming up on, you know, 8 months plus in terms of, you know, knowing that there's a new virus circulating, if you will, you know, in our communities. And so from your perspective, you know, you've seen a lot of infectious disease in your time. You know, how would you place this particular virus on the spectrum of the viral diseases that, you know, we've come to know and either appreciate their potential effects as well as, you know, how to treat them? Well, how does this fit in? Because, you know, we hear things all the time. Oh, it's a cold. You know, if you've had coronavirus, this is just another line of the same song, right? It's another coronavirus. Oh, it's like the flu, but it's not the flu. You know, it's just another flu-like virus. And I know you've seen a lot. And from your perspective, you know, what is this virus like? What is it doing to people as well as from the epidemiologic standpoint?
Well, I think we have to go back a century. We have to go back to the 1918 pandemic with the influenza pandemic that killed somewhere between 50 to 60 million people around the world, to go back to find a virus as difficult to deal with or as severe and as bad as this one is. Now, we have a lot more we can do than we could do to help people than existed a century ago. But this is a virus that within a few months was able to get around the entire world. It was able to, it's very clear, infect people very easily. It's transmitted very rapidly. When you look at the spectrum of viruses, the evidence is that for every person that's infected, that person can infect at least 2.5 people on average. So the opportunity for this to spread very rapidly is pretty remarkable, and it has done that. And you can see that cases double within a very short period of time. So when we deal with a new virus such as this, which has a somewhat, at least 5 to 10% of people with symptomatic infections end up in the hospital, you can see why with a rapidly progressing disease, high numbers infected simultaneously, we can easily overwhelm the hospital systems that are in existence in this country now. So as a result of that, and we're seeing this, we saw this in New York and New Jersey, and we saw it earlier in Louisiana, and now we're seeing in other states across this nation that the medical care system is inadequate to handle all of the rapidly emerging cases associated with this virus. So I think on the scale of things, we're at least as severe as the 1918 influenza pandemic virus.
You know, you may remember the book, The Great Influenza, was published a number of years ago, and the author of that book, Mr. John Barry, was on our show several weeks ago and offered a number of interesting insights with regards to, you know, how public health officials, politicians, as well as the community at large, responds to a public health emergency. And it's interesting how, you know, those things sort of triangulate to determine whether or not, you know, you win or you don't. In places where Philadelphia was a good example that he mentioned, where they didn't really take it seriously, it was massive and it was devastating. I think the mortality rate in Philadelphia was like 25%. But in San Francisco, the public health officials were listened to by the politicians and then in turn by the community at large, and measures were taken to prevent the spread, and the mortality rate was much lower. And so it seems to me like we've got, you know, this three pillars of prevention that have to take place for, you know, everyone to be on board with regards to singing the same song, you know, being consistent with message. And so from your perspective, how would you say that we're doing with that in terms of aligning public health officials with the information that's conveyed by the government that transfers really the informed data from public health officials to people that inform the public, whether it's the media or politicians or some combination thereof, to the community? How are we doing relative to the 1918 Philadelphia versus San Francisco? Where are we?
Well, unfortunately, I think we're seeing some of those same issues play out in the United States. I think we've seen around the world many other countries that, as outbreaks occurred, formulated public health strategies that developed significant control of the viral infection. And as a result, large numbers of cases were rapidly diminished. And now those countries have reasonable control of the virus. Unfortunately, in the United States, we haven't really developed a strong national strategy by which other by which states and local governments could work to within that framework to control this viral infection. So that's why I think we're at a point where in many places we're seeing the highest rate of transmission of this virus from that we've ever seen within this 6 to 7 month period of time. And so I think in many areas we're losing control of this virus, and we don't have much time to initiate the science-based public health strategies that we need to control this and get us to the position that many other countries have already achieved.
I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and you're listening to Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. Our topic tonight is none other than the COVID-19 pandemic. If you have a question about this topic or a comment to offer, you can call us at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. Our guest tonight is Dr. Joseph Bocchini. He is the chief of pediatric infectious disease here in Shreveport and is currently with the Willis-Knighton Health System. You know, Dr. Bocchini, we were comparing this this virus and this pandemic to the pandemic that occurred, you know, almost, I mean, it's really sort of surreal that it was almost to the day or month 100 years ago that something really severe happened. I know we had H1N1 and SARS and MERS, but in terms of something getting around the world efficiently from viral transmission, this is very similar. One thing that's happening, and you know, the questions are, you know, we're going to use a few parallels, is that you know, the information that is transmitted from hospitals, testing centers, now we have clinics, you know, it was predominantly hospitals in that day and age, but we have testing centers, we have hospitals, we have laboratories. They get the data about the virus, about who tests positive and when and where. And the perspective of public health is to make sure that that information gets to a central place. And so someone well above the fray can look at it and help to manage where resources need to be allocated, right? That's why we collect data, is to dedicate resources to help individuals, to help people. And so from what I understand is that the central database in Washington is going to be now directed by the HHS as opposed to the Centers for Disease Control. And I know you're not a politician and you're not an appointed public health official, but you have worked on the national level with vaccinations and you've worked with the CDC. Educate us, if you will, what's the difference between HHS, a division of the executive branch of our government in that administration, and the CDC, and how this change could potentially impact us on a community basis in terms of the reporting of this virus?
Well, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, is actually a branch under HHS. And it has always been the agency responsible for the public health of the country, and has the epidemiologic expertise to evaluate infectious risks within the country and help to formulate national goals or understanding and of particular diseases. So I'm not clear as to why that part of what CDC does is suddenly removed from CDC and taken into a different part of the agency. The CDC has always been the agency that has collected epidemiologic data about every infectious disease that occurs within the United States and has done so for diseases around the world as well. So I think that if there was any tweaking that needed to be done to the system to meet the standards that we're all looking for reporting and categorizing cases of COVID-19, it would seem to me that the best way to do that would be to build on the resources that we already had rather than to start all over again. So I'm not sure that I don't understand why that decision was made. I think that CDC has the capability of doing what's necessary for us to understand what's going on with this virus.
All right. This is Dr. Randall Brewer. We're listening to Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. The topic tonight is the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic. Also joining us tonight is Dr. John Vancheri. Dr. Vancheri is the Vice Chair of Pediatric Research and Chief of Pediatric Infectious Disease here at LSU Health in Shreveport. Dr. Vancheri is joining us via Zoom. I noticed he had his mask on, even though he was here via Zoom, and I'll have to congratulate him on his diligence in terms of practicing appropriate public health measures. Dr. Vancheri, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks, Randall. Good to be with you. And yes, we are socially distant about a couple of miles or so, and that ought to do it. There's nobody else left in the building, so I can take my mask off now.
All right, excellent. All right, good work, doctor. From the standpoint,
yes, sir. On the last question, though,
yes, sir.
The report I heard in morning on the radio on NPR was an interview with one of the CDC officials who said that the reporting mechanism, isn't bypassing CDC. The same data will come, but it is a new reporting system that give CDC and the White House information on a more timely basis. But like Dr. Bokini said, the real problem is that if the White House is getting in the business of interpreting that data and doesn't have necessarily the expertise that CDC has to do it.
So from the standpoint of the CDC, it seems like unfathomable to me that they would be not in the loop. Are they going to be CC'd on this data, if you will?
It sounded very much like, as the director of CDC had commented on it publicly as well, that that this is basically a novel data, new data collection mechanism, but that the information would go to CDC as well as the White House, and collect additional information that the standard CDC reporting methods, which usually are a couple of days behind, don't collect. So it sounded like there were some political nuances that they were trying not to be offended, but also that they recognize that they accelerate in the data that they can.
You know, Dr. Bocchini, from our standpoint, we know that our, you know, Department of Health gets data as well. And so we can still go to the original source, if you will, and go to the Louisiana Department of Health and get accurate numbers. Is that not correct?
That's yes, that is correct. I think each state really is responsible for its own public health system. And so the system is in place to report cases into the Louisiana database, and that I would think would not change. So we should still have that data available. And that's really important for us on the ground, because on a daily basis, following the cases, following hospitalizations, following ventilator use, following deaths, really important ways for us to understand what's happening, not only in the state, but in each different city, each different community, each different zip code. I think those are really important for us to understand what's happening with the pandemic.
So you mentioned, you know, positive cases, you mentioned hospitalizations, and you mentioned mortality. Those are three really important numbers. And, you know, the argument that's been made to me, you know, the argument that is pro-opening arguments, is that, yes, sure, there's a lot of cases out there. There's going to be, because people are moving around and doing more things, but we don't see that many more deaths, and we're not seeing, you know, the hospital systems being overwhelmed, at least locally. And so what, if there are any, are the problems with that logic, saying it's okay to endorse this sort of, it's here, let's live with it sort of philosophy? And what are the Louisiana numbers looking like as we've, you know, gone to really just phase two? We've just really gone halfway towards a full recovery of normalcy.
Right. Well, I'll start with that, and then I'll let John add into it. But I think the important thing is, when we make decisions about what to do next, we're not going to wait until the system is getting overwhelmed. We want to make changes so we could change the curve of the height of the infections, the number of infections, and then their consequences. If we see a rise in cases, which is what's happening now in Louisiana, we would expect that within 2 weeks we would begin to see a rise in hospitalizations. And in fact, if we go back to Memorial Day weekend, that was roughly when we were reaching our low point, and we had gained very good control of the virus. Somewhere in early June, we had reached a point where in Caddo Parish, the positive test rate was around 5%, so we had achieved the under 10% that we were looking for. And the number of cases in the hospital around the state and on ventilators in the, around the state had reached their low point. Well, now we're in the middle of July, and the numbers of patients in the hospital have increased to levels that they were in early May. The number of patients on ventilators are back over, I think it's around 1,400. It was down to well below 1,000. I think we've reached a point where hospital rates of utilization are up. And so we want to make sure that we address these now rather than waiting for the numbers to increase so much that we lose control of being able to handle the patients that need us in the medical system.
You know, Dr. Bocchini, this sort of, you know, reminds me of what we talk about, you know, in medicine is area under the curve. You know, is there going to be, you know, just that much virus and penetration out there such that there's going to be a curve, whether it's a curve that looks like an inverted V or a curve that looks like, you know, a very gradual sloping hill that goes down? Is the area still going to be the same? Is this virus so efficient, as you initially mentioned on the first time you did this show, that it's going to stay ahead of us no matter what we do, as long as we continue to have, you know, human-to-human contact?
Well, one of the things that we know based on the what happened when we introduced significant stay-at-home orders, closing schools, closing businesses, we clearly altered the spread of this virus. So we do know that we can mitigate its spread, we can modify that curve, and then hopefully we could reduce the number of people that are infected, especially those that are at higher risk for hospitalization or death, until we have either better therapies, but even more importantly, an effective vaccine. And so we know that we can change the course of this viral infection by the strategies that we used. And so I think that when we open up, we need to open up in such a way that we control the spread of the virus as much as we can. So if we're down to low numbers of cases, it enables us to not only find the case, but to do contact tracing so we can identify the people who were exposed to that individual. And then we can isolate them and then that all helps reduce the spread of the infection. If we have lots of infection within the community, it becomes very difficult to contact trace. If we have large groups of people coming together, it's almost impossible to contact trace. So we really need to be smart as we open up, and we could very effectively reduce the spread of this virus.
I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and you're listening to Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. We are discussing the COVID-19 pandemic. Our guests tonight include Dr. Joseph Bocchini, Pediatric Infectious Disease Chief here in Shreveport with the Willis-Knighton Health System, as well as Dr. John Vancheri, Vice Chair of Pediatric Research and the Chief of Pediatric Infectious Disease here at LSU Health in Shreveport. Dr. Vancheri, are you still with us, sir?
Yes, sir. So the in terms of the reporting, the state, as Dr. Bocchini said, you know, we'll maintain reporting every morning by 10:30. Every hospital in the state is required to report to their local public health the number of cases they've had, and their COVID and non-COVID. Right now, the data that just came out today is that there are 14 hospitalized patients in Indiana with COVID-19. 162 of those are on ventilators. But from yesterday to today, there are 1,000 new cases confirmed and 167 new admissions overnight. And this, especially if you look at a place like Calcasieu Parish down around Lake Charles, they've had 270 new cases just overnight from yesterday to today. And while in Caddo Parish, we've had only 84. So they're having three times as many cases per day as we are in our area. As Dr. Bocchini has said, and we've talked about, you know, previously, this virus is spread predominantly before people have symptoms. And that's the reason that masks and distance are very effective when other things are not. And we have spent a lot of time and energy in our nursing homes, over 25,000 tests in our nursing homes alone just in Northwest Louisiana by my team, to protect our most vulnerable patients. This curve it plateaued and came down, and now it's going back up more steeply than it originally did, and it's already higher than it originally was. And I think you're right, Randall, that the area under the curve may not be different, you know, when we look back in 2 years. But what will be different is the death rate.
Right.
Because by slowing the curve earlier, in early, you know, March, April, May, by flattening the curve then, we learned an awful lot about how to treat and take care of these patients better. And that has evolved. So initially, a lot of more patients, a higher proportion of patients were going on ventilators. Now they're using other methods to avoid going on the ventilator, on the breathing machine, and that changes outcomes, and that changes the consumption of supplies and the like. So there are a lot of things we're learning, and that learning helps us have better success with treatment down the line. And flattening the curve also has really bought us time to have the development of clinical trials. And Dr. Bocchini and I are both involved in numerous clinical trials of new medications, new strategies to fight the virus directly, to alter the immune system in important ways, to prevent the hyperreactivity that is mostly responsible for the death. So buying time is critically important to the ultimate success in getting through this pandemic.
Yeah, in terms of buying time, you know, Dr. Vancieri, I know you're on the pediatric spectrum, and you know, there's so many things to talk about with regards to this virus in terms of prevention, you know, personal responsibility. But from the standpoint of transmissibility, you know, the thing that's on everybody's mind right now is, you know, should kids go back to school? That's, you know, that's the elephant in the room. I know everybody wants to go to football games. We all want to go to church. We're going to concerts. There may be even somebody out there who wants to go to a bar. But from the standpoint of this virus and what you know, Dr. Vancieri, about the transmissibility of this particular pathogen, is it safe for kids to go back to school?
The answer is yes. And I know you. But I have, you know, told people many times today is that risk will never again be. So we all have to get used to what is new. And but we know our experience now with pediatric population is that bad outcomes, that is hospitalization and death, they're there with the virus. So while it is more transmissible than the flu, it does not appear to be more pathogenic in the number of deaths that it causes compared to the flu. And so we have to go back with a different attitude in how kids go to school. So kids can wear masks. That will help. Distancing will help. That, yes, changes how we interact with a lot of things. But it makes the risk much. Right now, the answer is never be zero. We know the strategy to reduce that risk. That reduces the risk, you know, by more than 90%. Wear masks. So I think it is safe for kids to go back to school. And we also know that's the best for kids in terms of their growth, development, continuing education over time. They need that schedule, they need that team that will help them.
Dr. Vancieri, we're having a little bit of trouble with your audio. I'm going to bring you down and let our producer work behind the scenes to try to improve the quality of the audio on your feed. We, again, really appreciate your participation with us tonight. We are doing our best with regards to social distancing, and the Zoom platform has worked really well, and so hopefully we can resume that soon. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. You're listening to Health Matters tonight. Our topic, again, is the COVID-19 pandemic. You can call with a question or a comment at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. You know, Dr. Vancieri mentioned, Dr. Bocchini, a few places where it seems like there's almost like a whack-a-mole type of phenomenon where you'll have a spike here and mitigation will happen. You know, cases go down and then all of a sudden, you know, there's a spike in another place. You know, it seems as though, you know, Arkansas as well as Texas, you know, they've seen, you know, a lower case fatality rate relative to Louisiana. I think that it's 111 deaths per million in Arkansas. Texas is 125. And then you look at Louisiana, it's 750. Mm-hmm. And could it be that Louisiana sort of got our mortality out of the way early, and that we're doing our best, and that our case fatality rate's gonna go down over time, and these other states are sort of behind us, or are they doing something that we didn't do?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons for the difference. The first is in Louisiana, many of the early infections occurred in closed units, nursing homes, retirement homes, where the population is more elderly and where there were a significant number of cofactors that were associated with a higher morbidity and a higher mortality. I think the cases that we're seeing now in Louisiana are younger. The average age is much lower. And I think in Texas and Arkansas, that's been the experience. They're having cases in younger populations, fewer comorbidities that are associated with mortality, and therefore their mortality rates are lower. And then, as John said, in addition, now we've learned a number of things on how to treat these patients that probably are having a significant effect on overall mortality. So although we don't have sort of the ultimate cure for an infection, we know better how to provide respiratory therapy. I think, as he mentioned, there's an effort to try and reduce likelihood of going on a ventilator, which has made a big difference. We have remdesivir. We have a better understanding of the inflammatory response that occurs in the third phase of the illness that has a significant amount of morbidity and mortality because it also attacks the lungs, the kidneys, causes a series of very significant organ system changes that has associated with high mortality. So we've learned how to address some of those changes. We've learned about blood clotting abnormalities and been able to reduce those side effects as well. So I think we've made a number of efforts that have led to progress in treatment that probably also has had an impact.
And if you look at New York, let's say, compared to, you know, other big states, the numbers would look similar, maybe on a larger scale. Mm-hmm. That there was a lot of initial mortality. You know, the Lombardy region of Italy was noted for that. And Right. Now the case fatality rate has gradually decreased. Right. It's sort of like there was a surge of inoculum in the vulnerable populations, and you saw a high case fatality rate early. Right. And now we're seeing more community-based case fatality rates.
No question about that. And I think if you look back to the early data on ventilator care, the early data from New York was that 80% of individuals who went on a ventilator died. Now that's markedly changed, that even though we've been able to keep many people off the ventilator, but in addition, if you require ventilator care, the outcome is much better now than it was in the beginning.
Let's go ahead and go to the phone lines. We've got Eric from Lufkin. Eric, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Hey, Dr. Brewer, thanks for having me on. We couldn't really hear the pediatrician very well, so I was wondering if you could maybe just repeat some of his ideas about the safety of reopening schools, and then what, if anything, should we be on the lookout for children who are infected in the long term in terms of their pulmonary function status or susceptibility to additional illness later on?
Yeah, I apologize for some of the technical difficulties we had, and we're going to see how Dr. Vancheri sounds now. Dr. Vancheri, are you there?
Yes. Is that better?
Oh, yeah, that's much better. Eric, I hope it's better for you. What do you think? If you could replay those comments that you had a few minutes ago about, the pediatric burden of disease. Is it transmissible between kids and from kids to adults? And, you know, even kids who have mild symptoms, are there sequelae that we should be concerned about?
Right. So, you know, the short answer is yes, there is transmission from child to child and from adult to child and from child to adult. There's no barrier there except the mask we wear, which we should wear. And so it is safe for kids to go back to school because that is, number one, important for their routine and their growth and development. And number two, we have the mitigation strategies. We know how to prevent the spread of this virus. I'll give you guys an example. I'm being very transparent here. I was swabbing a teenager about 12 days ago and swabbing his nose. This was a teenager with absolutely positive, rip-roaring infection with COVID-19. I was wearing a simple mask, and I was foot and a half away in this young man's face. After I swabbed him, he coughed directly in my face. And the good news is I didn't get infected, and it's because I was wearing a mask. And it wasn't a very complex mask, simple surgical mask. A cloth mask prevents those droplets that are the big transmitters in the cough and in the sneeze from getting into my mouth, especially my nose. And so masks very definitely work to reduce risk. And kids can wear masks at school and use the social distancing strategies that makes it safe for them to be there. The long-term implications are obviously not very clear at this point, but there is not a lot of indication of problems with lung disease in the long term. We know that COVID-19 can, like other viruses that we get, other coronaviruses and other routine cold viruses, can exacerbate asthma. But we're not seeing a lot of that at present. We're not seeing a lot of sort of side effects of COVID infection like asthma exacerbation that would require hospitalization. We are tracking and have had several cases of what is called the multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children. MIS-C is the acronym, MISC, that is not yet well understood. We believe it's more of an autoimmune or autoinflammatory response to COVID-19 that occurs later in infection, even when kids have had infection with no symptoms. And the report I saw and watched from CDC today has over 350 children nationwide, almost 400 children nationwide have had this inflammatory syndrome that is very serious. And I know Dr. Focchini has treated several cases over at the Willis-Knighton Hospital System. And so I'm going to let him speak about that syndrome in particular. But that is a very rare outcome of COVID infection in children.
Eric, thank you so much for calling and participating in Health Matters tonight.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's go to Tony from Nacogdoches. Tony, thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight.
Well, thanks. And thank you very much for having this program. I've been listening very religiously to the news on the Red River Radio, and it's been marvelous.
How
Are
can
you
we?
For my question.
Yeah, how can we help you?
Okay, I also called because I couldn't hear what he said, but even after he's sort of given a review of what he said, I didn't hear it really mentioned this particular aspect of things. I guess I worry about it because I'm in one of the high-risk groups, but I'm very concerned about something that I don't hear mentioned very much. In fact, I haven't heard it much mentioned at all in the latest news about the school reopenings and the pressure for that. I'm not so worried about the kids, and I don't say that lightly. I don't mean that I don't worry about the kids, but I'm not as worried about the kids and their particular health concerns as I am about the people that they will interact with. And from what I understand, they're still infective, even though they may not come down too much with the disease. They may not have very serious cases of the disease themselves, typically, but they can still infect others. And I know that certainly in many populations, they live very often with their grandparents, and even their parents may be older, though not likely in the high-risk group that I'm in. I worry a lot about kids passing it on to other adults when they get home and they take their masks off. And, of course, I worry about little kids who really can't understand the reason for masks and are not as compliant as we would like them to be.
Yeah, those are all really good questions and valid concerns. And we also have vulnerable populations who are in the essential worker population in our public school system. We have teachers, we have coaches, we have counselors, people that work in the office, bus drivers. You know, there are so many facets to this reopening question. And so, you know, Dr. Bocchini, what's your take on transmissibility when it comes to kids? And, you know, are kids more likely than, let's say, an adult or a young adult or a middle-aged person to become a super spreader, if you will, an asymptomatic carrier, and spread to a vulnerable person, or do they have a different course of illness? And Dr. Vancieri, please offer your input as well regarding this issue of really, you know, child to child at school and then child to someone else who's vulnerable at that point. Dr. Bocchini first, if you will.
So we do know that infection can spread from child to child and child to adult. We do not have enough data to know how frequently that would occur, how much virus a child has, and how long a child could be communicable to spread the disease. So I think that John's earlier point is the important one. To have children back in school successfully, the schools need to be repurposed in such a way to reduce the spread of infection, because we do know that as long as the virus is circulating, it could enter the school with a child or an adult, and it can spread among susceptibles. So our goal would be, and this is what you're seeing as the different school boards roll out their plans for a safe reentry to school, that there will be mitigation strategies. There will be opportunities to make sure the children aren't sick when they come to school. There'll be, in some cases, temperatures taken. The older children from grade 3 in Louisiana, the recommendation currently is that grade 3 and above wear masks. There'll be opportunities based on whatever phase of mitigation we're in to decide how many children need to be in the classroom, what the distance is. The American Academy of Pediatrics is recommending that children be at least 3 to 6 feet apart in the classroom. And then good hand washing opportunities, frequent hand washing, frequently cleaning the bathrooms, separating children at lunchtime. So there are a whole series of things that could be done to reduce the risk of spread within the school. And so our job right now, I think, is to do our best from now to when school starts to follow all of the rules to try and mitigate the spread of this virus so we have less virus circulating in the community when school starts. Because the more virus that's circulating, the more opportunities there are going to be for children to be sick in school or to have the virus, and that's going to trigger responses. Sending children home, it's going to trigger a response in terms of what to do with the other classmates, what to do with the teachers. And so we want to try and reduce the amount of virus in the community as much as possible before school starts. So the balance between starting schools is going to be schools, public health, and the degree of virus circulation. That's all going to together help us decide what's the best time. As you know, Caddo Parish has already decided to delay start of school for 2 weeks, and that's going to give us over a month to get better control of this virus before school's going to start.
Tony, thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight. Great question. Dr. Vancieri, what would you have to add to Dr. Bocchini's comments about, again, this important topic of spread within schools and spread then to other parts of the community with vulnerable populations?
And I definitely appreciate Tony's concern about that. So what I'd like to do is sort of compare to some other germs. So if we think about influenza, we know that the pediatric population, school-age children, amplify the spread in the community. That is to say, once kids begin to get sick, more and more adults get sick because kids are fantastic vectors for spreading influenza. That doesn't appear to be the case with this virus based on the amount of data we have available now. That is to say, before all the schools were closed in the spring, there were cases clearly in schools, but it wasn't apparent that the school was an amplification environment for the virus in the community any more than you would expect or any more than is happening in the non-pediatric population. What we've realized through public health and through case tracking and reporting is that bars are apparently an amplification environment. But again, that's related to not using the mitigation strategies that we know work. And so other germs where children are an indicator of infection in adults, for instance, tuberculosis is a good example of that. When there is tuberculosis in adults, kids show up with TB. So adults give TB to kids. Kids don't spread TB among themselves or give it to adults. Influenza, it's more the opposite. Kids get influenza and they spread it to grandma and to adults very, very effectively. But neither one of those scenarios seems to be in play based on what we know right now for the SARS-CoV-2 virus.
You know, you bring up an excellent point with regards to this interactivity on the, you know, virological level as well as on the public health side with regards to seasonal flu. Just because we have coronavirus doesn't mean the flu is going to take a break this year, right?
Right. Big concern.
And so from the perspective as a pediatric infectious disease expert, as well as with, you know, your knowledge of public health, you know, how important is it going to be to make sure that, you know, if we don't have a COVID-19 vaccine available in October, November, to have widespread flu vaccination this year in particular with the situation that we're going to have in the school systems and otherwise?
Right. I think, you know, flu vaccines are one of the primary mechanisms of saving lives. Vaccinating children against flu saves the lives of older adults. Very clear. And the schools are actually the best place to deliver influenza vaccine in terms of actually getting the vaccine uptake in the kids, because parents don't have to take off of work and they don't have to go to doctor's offices and all those things. So vaccinating against flu this year will be absolutely critical, because when COVID and flu are circulating at the same time, it will be difficult to tell them apart, especially in adults, because for other routine things, other colds, upper respiratory infections, adults generally don't have fever. But for COVID-19 and for influenza, they generally do. So we have to have two things happening. One is vaccinate against flu. We have a vaccine for COVID-19. Great. But none of us are holding our breath, at least through the winter. But the other very important thing that we in public health and all the hospitals are beginning to prepare for is, how do we make the diagnosis of flu and or COVID-19, and what might those two look like when a patient has both of them? Because when there's a lot of spread in the community, you will have patients with both infections and the potential that you have significantly worse outcomes in any given population because of both. So we're working to develop a testing strategy so that a single swab could be used to detect both flu and COVID-19 without having to do multiple tests. But we've got to bring that online to make sure that we can have accurate diagnoses going into the winter.
You know, it would seem to me that if we do what we say we're going to do and people participate, you know, we could see less deaths from the flu actually this year than we have ever seen. Yep. Based on widespread vaccination and then the social mitigation strategies, the social distancing that we're already doing for corona. Dr. Bocchini.
Yeah, I think, Randall, you're right about that. I think, as John said, this year, every year for a number of years, we have recommended that everybody 6 months of age and older get influenza vaccine. Right now, across the United States, children do a little bit better than adults, but only about 50% of the population gets their flu vaccine. So we want to up that as much as possible this year because, as John said, flu season is going to be complicated by coronavirus. And it's going to be very difficult to separate one from the other. And when we talk about things that have to be done in school because of concern about coronavirus, any febrile respiratory illness in a child is going to need to be treated the same way. So if we could reduce the incidence of influenza, we could make it a lot easier for schools to deal with children who might have coronavirus. And as John said, if we achieve higher levels of childhood immunization with influenza, we could protect a lot of adults as well as children.
And you know, Randall, you mentioned lower rates of death potentially. I mean, right now, our pediatric hospitalizations are very low, and we're not seeing things that we typically see in the pediatric population at this age. We're seeing less asthma exacerbations because kids aren't spreading viruses to each other. That's because of social distancing and masks. And so, you know, we're already seeing that these things work to prevent COVID infection, but they also work to prevent other things. Our patients with cystic fibrosis, who are very, very vulnerable in terms of their lung capacity, their lungs are at risk all the time. We're seeing very, very few hospitalizations for anything, including COVID-19 in that population, because they are social distancing and wearing masks. So we're going to see other benefits besides just preventing COVID-related deaths. We already are.
And in the United States, on average, each year, about 35,000 people die of complications of influenza. We have a vaccine to prevent that. And so this is really an important way to control a virus that we've already developed a vaccine for. We already have drugs, if we were able to identify those cases that break through following vaccine, that could modify the course. So it's going to be really important for us to get flu vaccine out to as many people as possible as early in the season as the vaccine becomes available.
Yeah, and, you know, and people mention, well, the flu vaccine doesn't always work. You know, sometimes the efficacy is anywhere from 10 to 60%. Let's just say it's in the middle of that. It's 40%. Well, that's three times as effective as remdesivir is
right.
for decreasing right. morbidity from coronavirus.
Right.
So we're not talking about a public health failure. We're talking about the regular battle against a very facile virus that was
right.
actually the one that decimated the world in 1918.
Right. And then there's some years when we have a very aggressive influenza virus where the mortality is much higher than 35%. But I think overall, I think even if the flu vaccine doesn't always prevent a case of influenza, if you have a case of influenza after the flu vaccine, it tends to be milder and with less likelihood for hospitalization as a result of the infection. So it can be helpful even if it doesn't work completely.
Absolutely. We may have time for one more question at 1-800-552-8502 or at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Vancheri, from the standpoint of testing, we're going to try to cover testing and vaccination here in the last 3 minutes that we have for the show. Can you give us an update on what our status is with testing? You mentioned, you know, simultaneous flu and corona testing. We seem to be running short on testing. Is this basically a supply-demand issue? We have excess demand relative to our testing supplies at the moment?
Yes, that's part of it. We have in this area of the state, we know LSU is doing a lot of testing through our Emerging Virus Threats Laboratory, and that's a laboratory that didn't exist 3 months ago, and we're already at a point where we're doing more than 5,000 tests per week in that laboratory now. It's focused really on COVID testing. So Willis Knighton, Ochsner, and Christus are all doing testing in their hospitals. But remember, they have thousands and thousands of other tests they have to do, whereas the LSU lab is really focused on the public health mission. And that's where the majority of our nursing home surveillance is going, as well as our growing correctional institutions testing is also going. Just in terms of nursing homes, talking about 4,200 residents of nursing homes just in Northwest Louisiana, and about the same number of employees in those nursing homes. So testing is ramping up in all places. The large commercial labs, Quest and LabCorp, are seeing some backups to 10 or 14, 10 to even 14 days to get results, largely because of supply issues. There was never as much demand as we have right now for testing. And we also know that some people are waiting hours in line in their car to be tested at sites when those are available in the community. So we and others are all trying to ramp up our testing to handle a larger volume of testing going forward, and to have creative ways to do that testing that can make it more efficient.
And Dr. Bocchini, I know you have a comment, and in the last 60 seconds, where are we with vaccination?
So the first vaccine made by a company called Moderna is now getting ready for a clinical trial to look at efficacy, how effective it is. They're in the middle of enrolling 30,000 individuals. And there are two subsequent vaccines that will be rolled out for the same type of clinical trial within the next 2 months in sequence. So it will take a while, but I think we have some significant vaccine candidates that could potentially be available. And as John said, probably not before early next year or spring, perhaps.
Dr. Joseph Bocchini, he is the Chief of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the Willis Knighton Health System. And I also would like to thank Dr. John Vancheri, Vice Chair of Pediatric Research and Chief of Pediatric Infectious Disease here at LSU Health here in Shreveport. You can find out more about COVID-19 at coronavirus.gov. The program tonight will be available via podcast at www.redriverradio.org. You can also find updates for Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas on Red River Radio's homepage. The producer tonight is Renee Moran. Thanks also to Kermit Poling, Wally Derleth, as well as other staff here at Red River Radio for putting this program together. The views and opinions expressed tonight may not reflect those of the station, LSUS, or its staff. Health Matters has been made possible tonight in part by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for joining us this evening. And tune in next Thursday for another edition of Health Matters. This is 89.9 FM KDAQ Shreveport-Bossier City, 90.7 FM KLSA Alexandria-Pineville, 90.9 FM KBSA El Dorado Camden-Magnolia, 88.9 FM KLDN Lufkin-Nacogdoches, and 100.7 FM KTYK Overton-Tyler-Kilgore. Thank you so much. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer for joining us this evening.